What's up, everyone? This is Anthony Pompliano. Most of you know me as Pomp. You're listening to the Pomp Podcast, simply the best podcast out there. Now let's kick this thing off.
Eric Tarzynski is the founder and managing partner at Contrary Capital. In this conversation, we talk about various innovative technologies. We talk about the future of venture capital, why they seek out people over companies, and what exactly he did to raise his first fund and build what is one of the most exciting venture capital firms in the world. I really enjoyed this conversation with Eric, and I hope you guys enjoy it as well. Once you get done listening, jump on Twitter and let us know what you liked, what you didn't like, where exactly we could have done better, and what you thought we did well. We always appreciate the feedback. Here is my conversation with Eric.
This episode is brought to you by LMAX Digital, the number one institutional crypto exchange. They offer clients the deepest pool of liquidity, and they have a 100% uptime track record through all the volatility spikes. LMAX Group's liquidity relationships and ultra-low latency technology means that LMAX Digital is the market-leading solution for institutions across crypto trading and custodial services. LMAX Digital, secure, liquid, and trusted. Go learn more at lmaxdigital.com/pomp. Again, that's lmaxdigital.com/pomp. This episode is brought to you by Arculus. If your cryptocurrencies are stored on an exchange, they may not be secure. And as we've just seen, your crypto can be lost in the blink of an eye to a freeze, exchange bankruptcy, or malfeasance. Now more than ever is the time to keep your crypto safe and secure in the Arculus cold storage wallet. Arculus knows a thing or three about security. Your assets are accessible through three-factor authentication and by using the Arculus Wallet app and Arculus Key Card. Your keys are generated and encrypted on their secure element rated CCEALP6+. If you don't know what that means you and only you own your keys and therefore your crypto. Keep your digital assets secure and safe from exchange freezes, bankruptcies, and hacks with Arculus. Save 20% through December 10th with promo code POMP. Go to Arculus and use promo code POMP today. This episode is brought to you by Messari. Your days of spending hours scouring the internet for quality crypto insights are over. Messari is your one-stop shop for all your crypto data and research needs. With Messari Pro, you can gain access to exclusive, industry-leading, long-form daily research reports, daily crypto news, advanced asset screeners, and curated sets of charts and protocol metrics. If you try Messari Pro today, listeners of the Pomp Podcast can get up to 25% off their Messari Pro membership by visiting www.messari.io/pomp or enter promo code POMP at checkout. That's www.messari.io/pomp and use promo code POMP.
Anthony Pompliano runs Pomp Investments. All views of him and the guests on his podcast are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Pomp Investments. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Pomp or his guests as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his personal opinion. This podcast is for informational purposes only.
All right, guys, bang, bang. I've got Eric here with me. I thought a great place to start would be you guys are very people focused. So, what makes a great founder? How do you think about you meet someone and you're like, you should start a company versus you meet someone and you're like, you should not start a company?
So it's great here. So, we actually think about it across two kind of pieces. We think number one, in terms of kind of like potential future founders, and then number two, like you're actually starting a company right now. Hey, how do we think about you as a founder, right? And so if you think about that first one of kind of like potential future founders, we think about it kind of through a few different vectors. We think number one, you know, like what is your body of work, right? Like what have you done in the past that shows some degree of kind of grit, of excellence? That's essentially a good predictor for kind of future success, right? And you know, odds are maybe you didn't even start a company in the past, that's fine. But maybe a world-class pianist or athlete, or like you've done something. So that's piece one. And then number two is we kind of think about, okay, well, what do the people that know you best have to say about you? It's essentially just kind of character referencing, right? So managers, colleagues, peers, whatever it might be, and kind of getting an understanding of your work ethic, character, how well respected you are, all of those kinds of things. And then the last piece is just a good old-fashioned conversation, right? I think one of the things we've learned over the past few years is if you kind of do your underwriting and kind of filtering the right way, the kinds of people that are going to start generational companies know. And they'll tell you very clearly, hey, you know, I'm at startup X right now, and I'm here to accomplish these three things, right? I'm here to learn what it takes to fundraise. I'm here to basically learn on somebody else's dime. And then I'm here to learn what it takes to be a world-class manager. And in 1 to 2 years, like, I expect to quit and start a company, mm-hmm. right? So you're looking with people that have just tremendous conviction and understanding of, like, what they actually want to do on the future founder side. Mm-hmm. I think when it comes to actual founders specifically and how we think about them kind of as people, I think number one is, like, we're looking for, is this person deeply, deeply knowledgeable and sophisticated about the space that they're building in, right? So we're not looking for, you know, Bobby who has an app idea and is doing it because it's cool that everybody else is doing it, right? We're looking for, you know, Pavle who has been doing synthetic biology research for a decade since he was in high school. And, you know, now he's starting a SynBio company and he's world-class in this space, right? And then we're also looking for, are they deeply technical? Are they good at sales? And are they scrappy, right? I think ultimately, you can be the best technologist in the world, but if you can't also clearly articulate and tell a compelling story and narrative around why this thing needs to exist in the world, you're dead in the water. So that's kind of how I think about it.
So when you meet someone and they're like, I'm great at X,
yeah.
how do you actually know if they're great? It's easy yeah. if you know, you won a world championship or you're yeah. an Olympic athlete and you got a gold medal. Yeah. Like, there are some external kind of validating components,
yeah.
but synthetic biology, how do you know that they're actually great?
Yeah. So we'll quite literally, I mean, for synthetic biology, right? Like, we'll actually go into the weeds with them, right? Like, we'll have them in depth walk us through their body of work over the past 5 or 10 years in SynBio, right? So we'll have them walk us through any research that they've done, projects they've worked on, professors that they've worked with, and talk to them, right? So we'll go as far down the rabbit hole for diligence as we possibly can. And then ultimately, you're able to suss out some understanding of, hey, scale 1 to 10, you know, how does this person kind of fit in? And then from there, you like, that's a piece of the puzzle, right? How deeply knowledgeable and sophisticated is this person? And then you're coupling it with everything else, right? With kind of like technical ability, what people have to say about them, their character, sales ability, all that kind of stuff. So
yeah. Move the microphone just in front of it. Like, pull it. There you go.
Yeah, cool.
And so as you're going through this, are you looking for specific things in the conversation? So, okay, you're a synthetic biologist, I guess is the right terminology, for the last 5 years. Walk me through your work. Are you looking for command of the information? Are you looking for, like, creativity in their work? Are you looking for, like, persistence? Or are you just like, this person fucking knows what they're talking about, and, like, this other person got exposed and they don't know what they're talking about?
Yeah, well, so I think that the single best heuristic that we've observed over the past 5 years of doing this now, when it comes to an early stage founder, is clarity of thought.
Interesting.
Right. And so you'll go and you'll talk to somebody, a potential founder, let's say, right? SynBio founder or direct to consumer founder, whatever it might be, right? And there's a pretty standard set of questions that you might want to ask somebody, right? A user acquisition or how you're building your team or what do you want to build, right? Whatever it might be, right? And the absolute top, you know, 0.1% founders, the level of clarity that they have about every single aspect of the business, it's pretty mind blowing, to be honest. Like, for the really best ones, right? I'll always kind of remember, one of our founders. We were talking about user acquisition, and a typical kind of, you know, founder for user acquisition might say something like, you know, oh well, like, we're just going to do paid ads, right? Going to do Facebook or Instagram ads, right? And when you ask them how they would acquire their first 500 customers, right? Mm-hmm. And this founder was like, no. Actually, we're not doing any paid at all to begin with. Instead, what we're going to do is this is like a kind of like pet wellness company. We're going to go to, you know, Washington Square Park, and we're going to do it on a Saturday morning from 9 to 12, and we're going to hand out these kinds of flyers, and we're specifically looking for, you know, 25 to 35 year old women who have, you know, disposable income of, you know, $150,000 to $300,000 a year. And then, like, we're also building a community, and which is, they would go on for 5 to 10 minutes on one small specific piece of the business. Mm-hmm. And that is how you know, I think, what's truly separating kind of like wheat from chaff when it comes to founders. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How did you guys get started? Like, this is such like a relatively unique way to do this. Yeah. But like, you're not doing it on Sand Hill Road. Yeah. You're not doing it from the halls of some massive institution.
Yeah.
You have a crazy, crazy story. Like, just walk me through, how does Contrary get started?
Yeah, for sure. So the story itself, actually, it's pretty wild. So from New Jersey, right? School in Boston. Really kind of found my interest in
school in Boston. Does that mean Harvard? No. Yes, no, maybe.
Northeastern.
All right. People say school in Boston. You never know.
It's a 50-50. No. So went to Northeastern. I was one of those guys who got rejected from, you know, Penn or some of the other Ivies and kind of
had I didn't even know those schools existed.
Yeah. Well, that's what happens when you go to like, I don't know about you. I went to like a public high school in rural New Jersey, and it was one of those places where the guidance counselors, as long as you got into any college at all, it was like job well done.
Yeah. Right? So, the whole college counselor in a high school really has a lot more power than people probably assign to.
Yeah.
Like in hindsight, like literally kids would go talk and they'd be like, I don't think that you should even apply to these 40 top schools. Instead, let's apply to a local community college. And like that literally sets people off on different paths in life.
It's egregious. I mean, 60% of my high school class went to a community college. 60%. It's crazy, right? And I think out of a class of 430, 10 of us, maybe 15, went to a private four-year university.
Wow.
Crazy. So I totally agree. It like sets you up on.
So you're one of 10 there. That's a sign of excellence.
Right. So got out. No. So went to Northeastern. Basically found my interest in tech and startups while I was there. So worked in a payments company, which is funny. It's a good story there. Toast was actually our biggest competitor. There were two seed stage companies in Boston about a decade ago working on payments for full service restaurants. One was us, one was Toast. Toast became a $10 billion company. We died. So that was my first kind of experience in building. And that was actually where I hatched the idea for what became Contrary, because I was in Boston spending time with a dozen or so people from the different universities, right? And Delian actually was one of them, right? He was at MIT at the time. And this guy, Nasir Yassin, Nas Daily, like Nas was at Harvard at the time, right? So there were a dozen of us, all of whom I thought were sharp, entrepreneurial, had good hustle, all of those kinds of things. And we're going to go on and do great things. But it was really interesting to me that when you actually took a step back, for people like this in their earliest days, nobody was actually doing anything in a systematic way to identify and capture that talent specifically. Mm-hmm. They were largely just left to this kind of random walk of life, right? And so had the idea originally for Contrary at the time as a result of that, went out to SF after graduated, was an early employee at a startup, and then maybe 3-4 years later swung back around to it when I was thinking about what I wanted to do next. And I knew that I wanted to spend the next decade plus building something really special and thought about that concept for what became Contrary and thought, look, you know, nothing like this exists in the venture world, right? You know, venture is still pretty traditional. It's still pretty, you know, two people and a dog, you know, seed stage fund in City X that are doing yet the same thing as everybody else. What if you could actually build one of the best firms of our generation off of that insight of the person before the idea? Mm-hmm. And so just kind of jumped in and the rest is history.
No, you didn't jump in. Come on. So you guys have found LPs at blackjack tables, on ski trips, all kinds of different ways. Yeah. Explain what is the fundraising strategy of Contrary.
Let's talk about the very first fund, right? So we're 5 years in, actually. Next week will be 5 years since starting, right? And so the first fund, right? So if we go back to kind of jumping right in, once I decided that I wanted to work on Contrary, right? I had to be all in, right? And when you think about raising money for a fund versus a startup, you know, I always thought that raising money for a fund would be harder, right? But I thought it would be doable. Maybe, I don't know, 30 to 50% harder, let's say, than raising money for a seed stage startup, right? Turns out when, you know, you didn't go to Harvard or you know, you didn't work at, you know, Sequoia or whatever it is, it's orders of magnitude harder, right? Mm-hmm. To raise your first fund when you have not worked in venture prior. And so one of our very first LPs, I essentially snuck into Salt.
Salt conference, like Anthony Scaramucci's conference.
That's right. I saw him a few years ago. I gotta tell. I don't think I've ever told him that.
How did you sneak in? Did you just like walk in and they just didn't stop you, or did you like go through the service door?
So there was a guy that I had cold email. So I found like a $60 round trip flight from SF to Vegas. Mm-hmm. And I was
those are lit. Those are wild if you're going at the right time on like a Friday afternoon.
Some of the most unbelievable experiences in my life. I once flew Spirit and an actual brawl started on directly across the aisle from me. And then it continued at the baggage claim.
Yeah, people don't understand. So like you're on a plane from San Francisco going to Vegas, which means everyone is going to party.
Yeah.
And some people start earlier.
Yeah.
And so while you're on a Spirit airline flight, it gets wild.
100%. Yeah. Unbelievable. Yeah. So had the $60 Frontier flight in, and then immediately it was a 24-hour gig basically, right? Yep. So I kind of, you know, land, went straight to, I think it was the Venetian or something like that, right? And I had cold emailed a few people beforehand and said, "Hey, saw that you're going to also be at Salt, right? let's meet up, right? Yeah, yeah." And so the one guy we were supposed to meet, and he said, "Hey, like I'm in this area, right, of the conference." And so basically went to the security people, right, who are kind of blocking it all off, and I said, "Oh, like I have a meeting with Mark, right? And like I'm not. I basically don't have a ticket or whatever. But like I'm meeting this guy down there. Like, can I get in?" And they just let me in, and they didn't even really ask. And so that was how I got in. And then I didn't leave the cordoned off zone for like 12 hours.
Yes, because, of course. Once you're in,
totally. Yeah. So I was like, I'm not leaving this. Right. So stayed in for the entire day, and then in the evening I left because I saw a lot of people were kind of flooding out. And then I went and just started playing blackjack at the various blackjack tables with people who had the Salt name tags on
smart.
Yeah. And so I just could have kind of go sit right next to them basically and strike up a conversation, tell them what we're doing. And yeah, it landed. We got two LPs out of that. You know, for our first one was only a couple million dollars, right? But you know, I got two LPs out of that. So
good trip.
15% of our first one. Yeah. And then I slept. Well, originally I was supposed to, the Frontier flight back was like 5, 6 a.m. the next morning. Mm-hmm. So in my mind, I was like, oh, I'll just stay up all night.
Of course.
And then go back.
How old are you at this time?
23, 24. Yeah.
Of course. That's what you're going to do anyways in Vegas.
So of like, course. But I set myself a budget, immediately lost it that evening, right? And so I will never forget this. I tried to sleep on the cold, hard floor of the Vegas McCarran International Airport with my backpack and had the most crippling lower back pain the next morning.
Yes. Yeah, of course. So, well, also, if you've ever slept in an airport, which I don't want to admit that I've slept many times in an airport, sometimes miss flights, but other times like, you know, why go get a hotel?
Yeah,
I'm going to take
course.
The flight in the morning.
Yeah.
And I actually have a video once. I was, you can't lose your bag. That's one of the big things, right? You don't want somebody to steal your bag.
100%.
So you like basically somehow lay on your bag or tie it to yourself or whatever. It's a thing. I didn't make the rules. It's a thing.
Totally.
And so I was laying there, and then all of a sudden I woke up at like 2:30 in the morning, and a guy is vacuuming.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And I was like so arrogant. I was like, "Hey man, I'm sleeping over here." And he was like, "Get the fuck out of my way."
Yeah.
Right? So like you forget
my job, bro.
Yeah, you forget that like you could try to sleep in the airport, but like it's not really that easy to sleep.
It is not
when things are going on.
It is not. And they had during like the, I don't know, 3 to 5 a.m., whatever, they don't let you even check in, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't even in the airport. I was in the lobby.
Oh, you were in the lobby. Oh,
when
I've done it, I've already been in.
Yeah.
And then you stay, you can't go outside the gate.
If
or
you have a connection or something, you can do that. But when you don't, like they shut down the airport for a few hours at night.
Yep.
And so it was literally just a cold, hard floor.
All right. So then you just go back and you're like, "I got two LPs. Good trip."
Yeah. And so it was that process for, you know, it took almost 2 years to raise our first fund, you know, which was ended up being like $2.5 million basically. And so, you know,
how many companies you invest the $2.5 million in?
About 20. Yeah. We've always run a pretty concentrated book. So the first one was, they call it 100K checks basically into 20 or so companies. We've always been concentrated, still are today. But yeah, I mean, you know, the journey of Contrary in the early days was just, you know, relentless scrappiness, right? It didn't really know anyone.
So you have scrappiness to find the LPs, but there's also this story where your largest LP on your birthday is like, "No mas."
Yeah.
I'm going to sit this one out. Explain that.
So same fund. Yeah. So same fund, right? So I spent, you know, almost 2 years running around, had 1,300 meetings to raise our first fund, right? Didn't know anybody.
Who are these people? Are they doctors, lawyers? Are they like other VCs? Are they founders?
Yeah, it's a combination. So it was a lot of tech folks, or ended up being a lot of tech folks. And then I'd say it was mostly split between Wall Street folks and tech folks. And the reason I ended up actually moving out to SF and living out there was because I would go on these trips to SF. I would crash on my friend's couch and I would go meet people. And the number of folks that I would get pinballed around to was unbelievable. And so, you know, people talk about, you know, the demise of SF or whatever. And I don't know what it's going to be like post COVID. But pre-COVID, oh, dude,
don't softball it. is it going to come back or is it not?
Yeah, look, I think that unequivocally it is still one of the best places in the world to build a startup, right?
I agree with that.
I think people don't understand how long it takes to build dense ecosystems of talent.
Yep.
And so I think, you know, will it ever be what it was? No. But on like a percentage basis, will it still be the number one place to kind of start a company for some time? Absolutely. I think that's my
although favorite. Miami yeah. people will get mad at me, but like I think that there's a high probability what you just said is accurate.
Yeah.
But what happened was there's more like dissipation of talent across the country and maybe even the world.
Yeah.
But it still is like a very good. If I was 22.
Yeah,
that's probably where I would go move.
100%. Yeah, I think you either go. So when we look at our own network right now, 40% of them are in SF, 40% are in New York, which is staggering, mm-hmm. and then 20% are everywhere else combined, mm-hmm. right? But that New York piece is actually the most interesting, right? Mm-hmm. Because that was 5%, 10% pre-pandemic, mm-hmm. right? And so that's like that's a massive tectonic shift, right? Mm-hmm. But I agree. I think like when you're in your 20s, being in SF, being in New York, if you're an ambitious person, I don't think it gets much better than that. I think kind of, you know, once you're a little bit older like us, right, and your network's built, you can kind of go wherever you want.
Go wherever. That makes sense. So, all right. What's the craziest company you guys have funded? Like the absolute most insane people say like, wow, these guys are morons.
Technology-wise or the founders are just nuts?
One of each.
Yeah. Okay. So in terms of the founders, I'd say it has to be this company called Zepto.
Zepto?
Yeah, Zepto.
How do you spell it?
Z-E-P-T-O.
Okay.
Yeah, so...
what does Zepto
wild
do?
So it's actually, it's like a 10-minute delivery company, like a GoPuff, but for India.
Okay.
And so we met the founders because they actually came inbound to us. And I think we've done a decent job of building kind of like a kind of, you know, brand within a demographic of folks. And so they came inbound to us and we didn't, I don't know if we knew this at the time, but they were 17. And so, and they said, hey, you know, we both got into Stanford. We want to build this company in India. If you give us 100K, we'll defer admission to Stanford and build this company. And so we said, okay, well, we've never done an investment in India before. Don't really have a network in India. Don't really know anyone in India, right? But these guys, going back to clarity of thought, it was unbelievable. I mean, for 17-year-olds, right, the level of clarity that they had about every single aspect of how they were going to go about, you know, getting their first customers, scaling this thing to the moon, like what they actually wanted to build long term was unreal. And so we said, okay, well, if we're really putting our money where our mouth is here and talent is what we believe in more than anything else, right? Like, let's just do it and see what happens, right? And so we gave them 100K and then tracked them for 6 months and they continue, they actually dramatically surpassed our expectations. They made some great hires. They were executing like hell. And so we gave them another few hundred thousand, half a million, whatever it was. And fast forward to today, 18, 24 months later now, fastest growing startup in India's history, 1,000 employees, hundreds of millions in revenue, and they're 19 now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't
crazy.
Unbelievable. Yeah.
When
so
you go
one.
Back,
yeah.
Was it just clarity of thought or was there other things that in hindsight you're like, man, that was a really good signal as to like this was going to happen?
Yeah. I honestly, I do think it was clarity of thought. It was, you know, the level of sophistication and thought and maturity that they had, they could have easily gone toe to toe with somebody twice their age.
Mm-hmm.
And so even if you just extrapolate off of that, right, and you say, okay, well, these guys are 17. Like, can you only imagine how good they're going to be in 5 or 10 or 15 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
Even if this company doesn't work out, you know, no hard feelings. It's $100,000. We live to fight another day, right? But the upside is massive. So, yeah, I think ultimately it's just when you spoke with them, you knew, hey, like these guys are special, right? And we're in a business of benchmarking at the end of the day, right? You're talking to hundreds or thousands of founders, and you're simply just trying to calibrate, hey, how sharp, sophisticated is somebody relative to their age, experience, whatever? And and these guys are off the charts. So
a lot of people don't realize how important big is in venture capital, right? We've seen a lot of companies blow up in the crypto world, all this stuff, and people are freaking out and they don't realize like, no, actually that is the entire venture capital model of it. You want it to be either as big as possible or it's going to end up being a big crater in the ground.
Totally.
But if it ends up being small, small victory or small loss, then actually it wasn't a venture type company.
Yeah. I mean, you could talk to LPs or whomever, right? Like if your loss ratio is zero, you're actually not doing it the right way, right? In venture. I mean, so if you take, you know, our portfolio, let's say like ours, right, which is typically, you know, pretty early stage, it's 75% of what we're doing is kind of pre-seed, series A. The remainder is kind of maybe series A, series B, a little bit of early series C. But if you're looking at it from a purely kind of pre-seed, seed, series A point of view, at the seed, in a 20 company portfolio, you know, we're underwriting that half of these are going to go to zero. And out of the remaining 10, 5 to 10 do kind of, sorry, 5 of them do kind of 1 to 2x in aggregate. And 5 of those out of those 20, but really 2 or 3 out of those 20 are the ones that are actually driving the returns. So yeah, I mean, that's basically how the model works. And the loss ratio needs to be higher than zero. Otherwise the venture model won't work. So yeah.
What is the craziest technology that you guys have invested in?
Yeah. So it's a good one. There are a couple options. So we invested in this company called Red Leader, which is essentially building software-defined LiDAR for all different kinds of applications, autonomous vehicles, whatever. We can
software-defined.
Yeah.
And all right. So LiDAR, just for those that don't know, explain it.
Yeah, so it's essentially you can think about it as kind of like what Waymo and if you've ever seen any of those like Uber autonomous vehicles, essentially what happens is it's sensors, right, that you're putting all around a vehicle, and ultimately it's building an image of the world, kind of directly in front of you, right, and then you're using kind of autonomous technology to help the car or whatever you're dealing with, a helicopter, navigate that.
And it's basically shooting light out and like understanding the object, the depth, all that type of stuff, right? You described it much better than I would, hence why I offloaded that to you. But it is a technology that is really, I think, self-driving cars where how most people have learned about it.
Yeah.
What is, you said software-driven LiDAR?
Yeah, software-defined.
Software-defined. What does that mean?
Yeah, and so what's interesting is if you look at some of the kind of incumbents in the space, companies like Velodyne or whomever, right, they are using a much more traditional kind of like tech and hardware stack, whereas Red Leader, this company, is like software is at the core of the infrastructure. They're not, it's not so much the LiDAR itself that they're innovating on, right? It's the software and the code actually that they're writing, which enables them to image at a dramatically higher kind of frequency than any of the existing folks. And so if we were to pull this up, and I could show you after, but you look at a demo video that they have, and relative to kind of like the current state of the art, and it's stunning. They literally invented math, like to make this tech work. It's unbelievable. And so they've been working on it for 4 or 5 years.
What are they using it for?
The initial application is going to be AVs, autonomous vehicles. But it has kind of a broad.
I recently saw. Hopefully, this isn't a competitor of yours, but I saw there was like a plane that was flying over the Amazon.
Yeah.
And they were using, I think, LiDAR, and they were uncovering civilizations along the Amazon River that were previously not known.
Yeah,
and wild. A huge piece of it was people thought it was so uninhabitable or whatever. But by flying over, even though there's the tree canopy, they were shooting the LiDAR down and like uncovering this shit.
Yeah.
And they were like, yo, people used to live there. Right.
Yeah.
And so like, again, it's different than autonomous vehicles, but like I was blown away. I spent probably 2 hours. I don't want to admit that, but I spent two hours on the internet, like looking at images of people's lives from thousands of years ago.
It's nuts. Yeah. It's absolutely nuts. Yeah. And so I think like these, like there are dozens of applications here, and frankly, a lot of LiDAR companies have been a total waste of money and time and effort, right? I mean, there's been billions of, I mean, I think Ford has always, has been, you know, 2 years away from autonomous vehicles for the past decade now. So I saw
Elon congratulate the Ford CEO on selling like a couple thousand electric vehicles.
Oh, really? Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So it's like, you know, the promise of LiDAR, the promise of AVs, who knows, right? But I think the raw tech, when you look at what Red Leader and some of these others have built, it's just stunning. And I think it makes you really excited for the future. So, yeah.
So Tesla has autopilot, whatever name they want to use. Yeah. But basically you can pull down twice on the freaking drive stick or whatever, and it stays in the lane on the highway.
Yeah.
That was like the only experience I'd ever seen was like, it stays in the lane on the highway, slows down if cars are in front of it. It can kind of tell, right? It's got the nice imagery, whatever. They have a recent update. Now it's driving in cities.
Really?
I have a friend who sent me the video. He's more courageous than me. He's sitting in his driveway. He puts in the coffee shop, like, you know, probably, I don't know, a mile and a half, 2 miles.
Yeah.
And he has to go to red lights, stop signs, turn, like the whole thing.
Yeah.
He like took a video.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh shit.
It's wild.
Like, you can just see like, okay, cool. Now I don't think it's anywhere near where like, you know, the whole, like people are going to be sitting in the back and no one's going to be at the steering wheel.
Have you seen what Cruise is doing though with the robo taxis?
No,
SF?
What are they doing?
Yeah. So they've done this. Yeah. Yeah. So they're exactly what you're saying. So if you go on, I think on Twitter, actually Kyle Vogt, who's the CEO, I think he has some videos, of, they just started it. They just opened it up to the public a couple months ago. And it's only in SF. And yeah, you can hail a Cruise, fully autonomous, end to end. And you sit in the back seat and the Cruise just drives you.
So an hour ago, Kyle tweeted and said, the press, they say autonomous vehicles are overhyped and are still 5 to 10 years away. And then he said, us, meaning Cruise.
Yeah.
At this moment, there are 100 Cruise autonomous vehicles in driverless mode in San Francisco, and many are currently carrying passengers.
Yeah.
And he has an image from two nights ago with all the little dots on it.
There you go.
Holy shit.
So it's definitely real with Cruise and SF. I think the question now is like, how do you actually scale this, right? I mean, they've been, the Cruise cars have been driving around SF for years, right? Mapping it and you know, I mean, there's just so many permutations of things that could go wrong, right? But they're doing it in SF. So, you know.
This episode is brought to you by OKX. They're the world's most powerful crypto exchange and now the second largest in terms of volume. It offers a comprehensive trading platform with over 730 spot trading pairs, 280 derivative markets, and 1,000 option markets. It processes 400,000 requests per second with 30 gigabytes per second of data throughput and 99.95% uptime. For pro and institutional traders, they've just launched the OKX Liquid Marketplace, which is an on-demand liquidity network with multiple brokers where you can instantly trade spot, derivatives, and multi-leg structures at the price you want while bypassing the order book. They offer up to a 50% discount now. So go to OKX.com to try it today. OKX.com, go try it today. This episode is brought to you by 8 Sleep. The holiday season is here, so give the never-ending gift of deeper sleep. About 2 years ago, I started to sleep on the 8 Sleep, and I sleep on it every single night. It quite literally changed my life. I get deeper and better sleep, but don't just listen to me. Clinical data shows that 8 Sleep users experience up to 34% more deep sleep. It is not a holiday miracle, even though it sounds like one. If better sleep is on your wish list, look no further than the new Pod 3. You can go to 8sleep.com/pomp for exclusive holiday savings and ring in the most wonderful time of the year. 8 Sleep currently ships with the US, Canada, the UK, and select countries in the EU and Australia. Go check them out, 8sleep.com/pomp today. This episode is brought to you by Compass Mining, the world's largest marketplace for mining hardware and hosting. With Compass, everyone can mine Bitcoin. You can do it at home or in one of their 23 hosting facilities around the world. All you need to do to start mining your own Bitcoin is go to compassmining.io today. Again, if you want to get into Bitcoin mining, go check out compassmining.io today. So they have the cars. They're all branded Cruise.
Yep.
And they have them like all parked in like a little parking lot. And then they're just taking off and they say, on your mark, get set, go.
Yeah. Yeah. Have you seen the video of the Cruise car getting pulled over by the police officers? This is hilarious.
No.
You got it. Maybe after this, whatever. You got to watch it. A Cruise you know, AV taxi got pulled over by some cops. I don't think they realized that there wasn't a human in the car.
Yo, so there's nobody in this car.
There's nobody in this car. Yeah.
I'm watching the video right now. YouTube will take it down if we put it up, probably. Yeah. But it says that they launched daytime driverless rides. Service is live for cruisers and will launch to public or whatever.
Yeah.
And literally, they have the video, and there is nobody in the driver's
seat. There's nobody in the car.
And they're interviewing these two ladies, and they're having the time of their life in the back.
It's nuts. It's nuts. Yeah. This is nobody in the car. Yeah.
So are they the farthest ahead?
I think when it comes to actually, I mean, they're the only one that I know of that has done this end to end right now. But it's just in San Francisco, right? And so we'll be curious to see how much they can, basically how quickly they can scale it to different cities, right? But yeah, they're the only ones that I know right now that are doing it like truly end to end in a city. It's wild. Yeah.
And they have videos of people, I guess, trying to trick the cruise vehicles at night. Like there's a guy, they claim, I think this is real. I mean, they have a video of them trying to do it. He says the driverless cruise autonomous vehicle was tracking both the person and the dog and managed to swerve to avoid a collision. Yeah. He said, risking your life to prank an autonomous vehicle is stupid, but it's your call. Just leave your dog out of it. And it's literally a video of a guy. It's at night. The car's driving down the road and he like is in the road and darts at the cruise, and the cruise swerves, avoids, and then like immediately slams on the brake.
Yeah.
That is nuts.
I don't doubt it. I mean, people are stupid, right? But yeah, it's crazy.
All right, so you guys got the LiDAR. What are other some crazy technologies?
Yeah.
What is the future? That's what I want to talk about. What is the future stuff that people are like, there's no way that's going to work?
Yeah. What are your thoughts on Anduril?
Anduril?
Yeah.
I love it. I'm surprised that it took Palmer and the Anduril team to say, hey, we should use the most cutting edge technology in the defense of our country.
100%. Yeah. I mean, that's what we should talk about, right? I mean, so we're investors in Anduril, and I think, you know, I mean, like you said, it's the most logical extension of, you know, talk about like tech for the future, right? And in defense of not only the country, but just democracy, right?
Yeah.
And it was funny, right? Because I think for a long time, Anduril was, I think, kind of tacitly like poo-pooed, right, amongst a lot of folks in the venture, the tech world, right? Mm-hmm. And then something like Ukraine happens, and all of a sudden you realize, okay, well, actually, maybe defense is important, right? Mm-hmm. It is important for democracy and for this country, right? And kind of building the next gen Lockheed, right? The 21st century Lockheed is an incredibly important mission, right? Mm-hmm. And something that if we're not going to do it, China or whomever's going to do it, and you know, that's it, right? So yeah, I mean, I think that's been fascinating. I had a chance to drop by the new. They just opened up some new headquarters in LA. Maybe 4 or 5 months ago.
It's cool.
Yeah, it's awesome. Yeah. Matt has given me a kind of like a tour of some of the new tech and buildings. And
How much of it is war versus like other types of uses? So hostage rescue or humanitarian aid or whatever. Like there's so many things that the quote unquote government or the defense contractors actually participate in. It's not all like, let's go kill people.
Yeah.
But how much of that business is the other stuff?
Yeah. Well, so Anduril, their whole model is essentially kind of predicated around the inverse of the traditional kind of defense prime model, right? Which is, you know, typically kind of you kind of wait for the DOD or whomever to kind of like put out some RFP, right? And then kind of you build something for it and you bid and then you build the project, right?
And you use the government's money to build the project. Right. So basically that's the government is taking the risk that you're going to be able to build it.
That's right. Yeah. Anduril's basically kind of flipping it on its head, right? And so they're building through discussions with a lot of folks, obviously in the defense community, right? But they're building products that they think will resonate ultimately, right? And they're taking that risk and then selling it, right? So the first one, the first kind of product they launched was essentially just like a sentry tower for initially for the border, right? And it's having a bunch.
What's a sentry tower mean?
Just like literally like a 25-foot tower that you'll put you know, on a ranch in South Texas somewhere, and it can be used to detect, you know, whether it's like illegal immigrants or drug.
It's got probably cameras. It's got like heat sensors, all that type of stuff.
Just, exactly. Anything you might imagine, like, sensors, like infrared, you know, you name it, right? And so, and then they're just putting all these different sentry towers every X, you know, miles, let's say, along the border. And so that was the-
So you're saying that Andrew built the wall?
Building a digital wall.
Yeah, okay.
So that was kind of like the
both sides of the political aisle got excited there.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. So that was kind of V1, right? And now they have a bunch of other product lines essentially that they're launching. So they recently acquired this company. I forget the name of it. I think it's based out of Australia, and they're building like an autonomous sub. They have another one that's essentially like an autonomous helicopter, right? Or they have another one that
this shit sounds like video games.
It's unreal. Yeah.
Like we're just gonna be sitting here with joysticks and we're like, oh, this my submarine just blew up your submarine that had no people in it.
Well, speak about like the future. I mean, the future, right? Like the future of warfare is a largely humanless future, right? Yeah. Like that's just what we're going to trend towards. I mean, the reason why societies get upset with war at times, right, is either, you know, it just goes on forever and costs hundreds of billions of dollars, number one, right? Or number two, like human casualties, right? So if you're able to remove human casualties from that equation, number one, it's a great thing for the world. But number two, you know, and this will be interesting, I do wonder if it actually ends up enabling more net new like microaggression, right? Because if you can just send your drones out.
Yeah, like my robots killed your robots, but like no humans died.
Yeah, exactly. If I have a lot of money, well, whatever, right?
Do you know what Talon robot is?
No.
Talon, T-A-L-O-N.
No.
So when I was in the military, at one point I was a combat engineer, which sounds... It has the word engineer in it. There's no engineering. basically, they were like, you guys are going to do roadside clearance. Like, go look for bombs. And basically, be bait.
Yeah.
Right? Like, horrible.
Yeah.
And so, in the train up to go to Iraq, they're like, oh, we have these robots.
Yeah.
And you're like, sweet, robots. That sounds cool.
Yeah.
And they literally would train. There was, like, actual people trained. And then they kind of, like, field trained a couple of people in case that person got hurt or, like, wasn't there or whatever.
Yeah.
And so this robot would like get out of the vehicle, like you'd like pull it out of the vehicle and you'd put it there and you're standing like as far away from obviously what you think could be a bomb.
Yeah.
And so you like maneuver it down there, like literally like a, you know, like a car or whatever, like a you know, remote control car or whatever.
Yeah.
You get it down there and then it's got this big ass arm. And it has like the pinchers on the end.
Yeah.
And it had a camera. So you're like looking through to see what it sees.
Yeah.
And the people who were very well trained could literally pick up like an M&M with the pinchers and not crush it.
Oh, wow.
Like that was the level of one, sophistication, but also two, the ability of the machine.
Yeah.
So we're like, we think we're badasses. We're let's go. We're there. We got the robot in the back, right? First couple of missions we go.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden we think we see a roadside bomb. We're like, get the robot.
Yeah.
Pull that bad boy out, go down. 4 hours later, not a bomb. Robot comes back, pack it up, go.
Yeah.
Half a mile down the road, we think we see a bomb. Guess what happened to that robot? After like three missions, we're like, leave the robot at the thing. If you're in one of the front vehicles, just run the shit over. We'll figure out if it's a bomb. And so like, I always think about like that specific experience as like, obviously the technology was incredible. Like at the time, it's 2008, 2009.
Yeah.
So like, you know, more than 10 years ago, they had this technology, but like, humans still had to use it.
Yeah.
And whether we were smart or dumb, we just left it behind and then would just go use it. So like, how do you think about the human element to some of these technologies that get built? Like, are we now at a place where the humans recognize like, no, this is actually better than the humans doing it?
Yeah. Well, I think we're getting there. Right. And like, I think per what you said, right. I think in 08 or 09, like, you know, there's a lot of tech that's just too far ahead of its time. I mean, this is the definition of hype cycle, right? Like this is what happens every one or two whatever years, right? I mean, right now we're in the generative AI hype cycle. I don't know if you saw the chat, you know, chat GPT-3 thing that came out yesterday, right? So like, you know, I think that's significantly more mature than the last AI ML hype cycle 3-4 years ago, right? But it was, you know, AI ML, it was self-driving cars, it was, you know,
crypto
for me. Yeah. It was, I mean, I don't know, right? We could keep going back. Every 1 or 2 years,
there's genomics. These
trends. Yeah, exactly. And the vast majority of them don't fulfill the stated aims, right? Mm-hmm. And they're just too far ahead of the time for the hype. But I think ultimately what happens, right, is your tech that in 08 or 09 was like incredible for the time, but still very little real world human applicability. You know, I think we're inching pretty close. I mean, you look at some of the videos now, what the military is using, or some of the robots, or even you look at like what Boston Dynamics has done, right? And you know, I we're not there yet, mm-hmm. With I think kind of human like hand to hand combat, for example, right?
You're saying humans could still beat up the robot, but like it's getting harder.
I think, and it's getting closer. Yeah, and I think when it comes to drones, I think we're pretty close, right? Like I think, you know, we're already pretty close, right? And so
I have a friend who lives in Texas, and you know, in Texas they think that they can't be fucked with. And so I remember joking with one day, I was like, "What are you gonna do when the drones come?"
Yeah.
And he was like, "I'm gonna shoot them out of the sky." And I was like, "That's a great answer."
Yeah.
But I was like, "Do you understand how quick these things are, or whatever?" And he like started thinking about it, and like you could tell that he didn't want to say it, but he was like, "Oh shit, I can't shoot that out of the sky."
No way. Or and if you have drone swarms, right? If imagine having to send 400 drones at you that cost a couple hundred dollars each to manufacture, and they're all attached with, you know, some small bomb or whatever, right?
What's up with San Francisco? They're arming the robots now to kill people.
I saw that just yesterday.
Is that real?
It's unbelievable. I didn't actually read the article, but
it's on the internet. You don't have to read the article. Just read the headline.
Yeah. Duh. I mean, yeah. If it's legitimate, then it's bizarre. Why would San Francisco be the first city to?
No, I don't think it's bizarre. I think this is like a perfect San Francisco thing to do. Yeah, is to like, oh, we have no law and order. To like, now we have robots with weapons as our law and order. But it's the same thing like the bathroom. Like the $5 million bathroom, whatever they had. I forget how much it was.
Yeah.
They have like a ribbon cutting ceremony because they built a public bathroom, right? And it's like, we have no infrastructure? No, look at this bathroom that we built.
Yeah,
same thing here. It's like, we have no law and order. People get mad. They're like, you know what the solution is? Just like put police officers on beats in the city.
Yeah.
Let's get robots with guns.
Yeah.
And it's to any normal person outside of like the bureaucratic like apparatus, you're
outlandish.
Like, I can think of a lot of ways this goes really bad.
Yeah.
And then by the way, like God forbid that these robots kill somebody.
Yeah.
And it comes out that they shouldn't have.
Yeah.
Who gets in trouble?
Yeah. Well, I mean,
this you go put the robot in jail.
Yeah. This goes back to the self-driving thing with like a cruise or whatever, right? Like, I mean, this is why they spent years and billions of dollars and millions of miles driven, right? Like to prevent this, because all it takes is one.
What's going on with GPT-3 and all these AI models? Like the generative art, for those that don't know, you basically type in a prompt. A prompt is just like a sentence. You could say like, show me a photo of a person sitting on a park bench with water behind them or whatever. Yeah. And it creates, it's awesome.
Yeah.
Like super cool.
Yeah.
Not very clear how people will use that, but like cool.
Yeah.
And now there's like, okay, now we have the chat. Now we have like more and more and more. How do you guys look at this?
Yeah. You know, I think for us, number one, we rarely, if ever, chase hype cycles.
Okay.
So I think as a firm, the view is that the hype cycles themselves, maybe you have one or two companies that emerge from these, that end up being some degree of successful, but the companies that are going to be multi-billion dollar companies a decade from now are often spaces that, you know, people aren't really looking in, right? They're kind of undiscovered, they're unsexy, like almost by definition, there's not a ton of hype behind them. So I should caveat all this by saying, like, yeah, we rarely kind of like engage in hype cycles. I think when it comes to something like GPT-3 specifically, or the generative AI stuff, you know, I think for me, there's always a question of like, what is the durable source of value that is being created at the end of the day? And is it sustainable, right? And you look at
but how do you measure that?
I mean, I think you can just look at it and like art is a good example, right? Like what, like the real world utility of me saying like, hey, draw a picture of, you know, Anthony sitting in the park, right? It's nice, it's helpful, but it feels a lot more like a feature than it does like a meaningful platform or something that people are going to pay, you know, SaaS style model of revenue off of, right? And so, I guess what I'd say is like, we're we tend to be skeptics of these kinds of things. And when you look at different like innovation waves, right, kind of like SaaS and mobile and whatever it might be, whether the advantages accrue to the startups or the incumbents, I think tells a lot too. So Elad Gil kind of wrote a post about this recently, which I think did a good job of encapsulating some of my views here too. But you know, I think the reason the mobile wave, for example, wasn't super protracted relative to SaaS, as an example, is because the incumbents, the Facebooks, the Googles, whomever, they ended up capturing a lot of that value pretty quickly, mm-hmm. right? Within like a really like the burst of time was like 3 to 4 year periods, like 2009.
Are there any companies that ended up being fucking massive that didn't work out of the gate?
Oh, all the time. But
no,
but
I don't. Which
with
one?
A pivot though. Yeah, yeah.
But like that's not. But that's not
okay,
the same.
So you're
company,
saying
right?
Like, oh, okay, yeah. I can't think of any.
If like Slack, case. Right? Yeah, I think you'd be like, oh, yeah, it was you know the video game or whatever, yeah, right?
Exactly.
But like Slack was a different product.
That's right.
And then it was like pretty obvious, I think, from what I understand from that story, like immediately.
Yeah.
Twitter was out of Odeo, yeah. But like. Pretty quickly, people were like, oh, this is cool, yeah. And it started to take off.
Yeah.
So, like, I do think a lot about, like, the 90-day or 180-day shot clock.
Yeah.
Like, if you start something and in 180 days it's not working, there is – it doesn't mean that it won't work. It just means that it's unlikely to be really, really big.
I think that's right. Yeah. I think when you think about, like, real generational companies, right, like the 10 billion-plus companies, there's usually something that – almost from inception feels like it's working. Yeah, I agree. I think there are other companies that you can make work over time, mm-hmm. but those end up being smaller outcomes. Yeah, I mean, we could talk about, I definitely have some views on just kind of like the ability of kind of like luck versus timing versus hard work versus whatever when it comes to building companies.
What are your thoughts?
I mean, I think ultimately like the simplified version is that a lot of these 10, 15, $20 billion plus outcomes, it is the confluence of all of those factors, right? Whereas if you're, I pretty strongly believe that like if you're a sharp person building in the right space and somebody who can kind of like listen to customers, like with enough grit over a 5-10 year period, like you can make something happen, right? I think you had Max Levchin on recently, right? And like this is kind of what they do with Affirm, right? It's like Affirm kind of like it's been around for a while, but you kind of listen and tweak the model, and like inevitably you kind of hit on like a burning need for a customer, and then you kind of hit the gas and go from there, right? So like these things exist all the time, but I think for the truly big outcomes, like in Airbnb or whatever, like pretty much from the beginning, you know, it was working, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah.
Where are you guys looking now? Like, okay, yeah. You're not chasing the hype cycles.
Yeah.
What are we all missing?
Yeah.
Where are the areas that you find interesting?
Yeah. Well, so I think for us, it depends on kind of what stage we're at as a firm, right? So pre-seed, seed, series A, we're laser focused on the person, right? Mm-hmm. We actually don't care what space they're building, right? I don't care if it's digital health or you know, fintech or infrastructure or whatever it is, as long as this is a person that, you know, we've known for a period of time, we think is top 0.1% and it's doing something really interesting, like we have enough conviction to write them a check at the early stage and see what they can make happen. When we get to a later stage, right, kind of call it series B and beyond, that's when we start to get more thematic, I'd say, as a firm, right? So I think that's when you look at a company, let's say, you know, fintech infrastructure, right? And you're looking at, hey, in the FP&A space, you know, what are the 5 companies that we think are world-class in this space right now? And what is the one company in that space that we think is going to win, right? That we think is going to be a multi-billion dollar outcome. So depends on the stage, but I'd say in general right now, we're still spending a lot of our time in like digital health and then what I'll call like fintech infrastructure. Like those are two spaces that we're excited
about. Will you guys not back a founder if you haven't known them before?
No, we will. We will. But I'd say it's the minority of what we do. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So if I kind of look at where we're deploying capital today, probably 30 to 35% of what we're doing is kind of from this closed loop network of folks that we've built, that we've gotten to know, you know, through our fellowship community, whatever it might be. I think probably 30, 35% is from our software platform. So we built a pretty sophisticated software platform. It's kind of systematically identifying and tracking great talent. And then we'd have what I'll call like traditional sources, right? Founder referrals, whatever it might be. And that's the remaining 20, 30%. Mm-hmm. That's essentially what the breakdown looks like. But all things equal, we like backing people that come from our network and folks that ultimately kind of like have a like we have some kind of edge in finding them first and understanding like, hey, why is Contrary seeing this deal, right? Not just getting the deal that everybody else has passed on. So mm-hmm. it's like real adverse selection there, I think.
Is this the future of venture capital firms? Like, is this what they're going to look like?
It's a great question. I mean, I think the answer is yes, but
Is it just one type of firm, or will this be one of many strategies that can be successful?
I think it'll be one of several, but if we look at a decade from now and you ask yourself, hey, Eric, what does venture look like in a decade? I essentially think three things will win. I think number one, you'll need some degree of technology at your core. I think number two, you'll need talent and community. And number three, you'll need distribution, you know, content, media, whatever, right? And I think the firms that will win, right, the next kind of Andreessens or YCs or whatever, will have all three of those in spades. And then I think, you know, there will be firms that exist that do one or two of those very well, right? Mm-hmm. Or even individuals, right? I mean, obviously, like, you've done a great job, right, of kind of building it like that last one, a distribution, right? Like, you have a, you know, world-class brand and community and whatever, right? So there will be pieces of the puzzle and people who can kind of carve out their niches within those. But I think if you're trying to build the next Andreessen or whatever, like, I think you need to ultimately have those three things in spades. So, yeah.
What are the strategies that people are chasing now that you think won't work in venture?
Yeah, I tend to be not as much of a fan of what I'll call like thematic venture funds, right? Okay. And there are some that do exceptional work, and I think are best in class. I think like a Ribbit for fintech, or an Amplify with enterprise infrastructure. Like there are some world class firms that do that, but I think there are a lot of firms that do that. And it's principally a marketing endeavor more than anything else, right? So they'll say, oh, you know, we're a cybersecurity fund, right? And as a result of that, you know, you should give us capital because we're, you know, deeply, deeply knowledgeable about this, right? But and so from an LP point of view, I think it can be enticing or alluring, right? Because you're saying, wow, well, I'm looking for a cyber fund, and these guys brand themselves as a cyber fund, so they must be the best, right? But when you look at the best venture platforms in the world, right? The Sequoias, mm-hmm. the Andreessens, the Founders Funds, or whomever, they're all generalists, right? And they're all generalists for a reason, right? They're generalists because the best companies don't discriminate, right? You know, the best companies are in enterprise SaaS and, you know, fintech and consumer and everything in between, right? Like, your job at the end of the day should be to identify and back the best founders, full stop. Mm-hmm. Regardless of what they're building, right? Regardless of the space that they're building in. So, yeah, I think that's kind of, I think one that I feel pretty strongly about. There's also some, you know, I think somebody like kind of some of the kind of like tier two, tier three accelerators as well. Like, I think that's a ship that has long since sailed. Mm-hmm. I think YC is, I mean, they've just built such brand equity at this point. But yeah.
One of my last questions for you is, if I want to start a company.
Yeah.
In the future, what is the things that I should do beforehand to get positioned to have the skill set, experience, network, et cetera, to be able to start that business? Let's say I'm coming out of college and I'm like, one day I want to start a company. Yeah. What is maybe not the only path, but a good path for me to pursue?
Yeah, I think it depends on the kind of company that you want to start, right? So I think if you're interested in starting, you know, in enterprise infrastructure company, right? I think that's a much different path than if you want to go start a fintech company or whatever company, right? And I think, you know, in enterprise infrastructure, for example, when you look at many of the very successful companies that have been started in that space, right? If you look at a Rubrik or a Samsara or whomever, right? They're started by people who are oftentimes in their 40s, typically, right? Who have spent 20 years basically like deeply understanding like how infrastructure works at large scale enterprises, right? Mm-hmm. So that's that tech, right? But I'd say for your typical kind of new grad, if you're thinking about, hey, you know, I want to start a company, the best advice that I could possibly give them is to go work at a Series A to Series C hypergrowth startup, one that's backed by, you know, a top five, maybe top 10 firm, one that has somewhere from 20 to 50 people. And then just go do whatever it possibly takes to learn. Just get your hands dirty, right? I mean, I think about it as like a ramp or a retool or whatever, right? Like, if you can get in early at one of those companies, the velocity of learning that you'll have over the next 2, 3, 4 years will be unequivocally higher than anything that you could ever get by working at a FANG company or working at a Series D or C or, you know, soon to be public kind of company. And you learn so much on somebody else's dime, brand, credibility, reputation, right? That by the time you're ready to kind of spin out and start your own company, you know the fundamentals. And you know, let's say you're working at Ramp, right? You don't have to go start a fintech company, right? It doesn't matter. At that point, you've learned a broad-based skill set that's pretty generalizable, right? Mm-hmm. And then you go build. So that would be my best advice. It's like if you're a new grad thinking about starting a company over the next 2 to 4 years, and you don't already have the idea that you want to work on today, go work at, you know, a Ramp style company for a couple of years, learn under some of the best, most ambitious entrepreneurial people in the world, and then spin out and do your own thing.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a great idea. Yeah. What about friend groups? Like founders who end up being successful usually tend to be around other founders that are successful. Is that fair?
Yeah. I think it's fair. I think like when we look at even kind of within Contrary, like the networks of people that have been formed, or even if I go all the way back to the genesis of Contrary, right? You know, a decade or so ago, I think the most ambitious people associate themselves with other really ambitious entrepreneurial people. And so when I look at the founders that we're backing who are, you know, earlier in their careers, right? I think kind of call it like 20 to, you know, 26, 27. Yeah, for the most part, I mean, they have a small pocket of half a dozen to a dozen friends in their city that they're living with, you know, living in a hacker house with, like spending time with, working on projects with, right? And this stuff matters, right? And it matters because you're building trust, you're building long-term relationships, you're getting to know someone. We just backed a company actually, seed stage, but you know, the founders went to college together, lived together, have stayed close, sorry, both in SF together, and you know, one just recruited another one from a startup to go start the company together, right? So like these things can take time to play out, but ultimately, you know, finding your tribe, right? Like finding your group of people is super important. And then that carries on to the company that you're at as well, right? If you look at, again, like a Ramp or an Andor or whomever, right? The early employees at those companies end up building their own versions of mafias, right? And they spin out and they all angel invest in one another's companies and they start companies together, right? And it's really powerful, right? And there are a small number of companies that have large numbers of entrepreneurial people. And again, like if you're a new grad or whomever, like those are the pockets that you want to look for, both in friend group and also in colleague group. So, yeah.
And when you think about your day to day, what does your like normal schedule look like?
Yeah. Ebbs and flows by the time of the year, I'd say. But, I'd say typically today I'm in more of like a CEO style role at Contrary. So we have about 20 people on the team now, 5 on the investment team, 15 kind of helping us build the talent identification machine, right, across engineering and data science and talent and so on. And so I spend probably maybe a third of my time recruiting, trying to kind of bring world-class people on the team and kind of level up with every single hire. I spend probably a third of my time on some combination of fundraising or managing the team, right? And kind of like setting strategy, vision. And then probably the remaining third on investing and supporting existing founders. So that's roughly the allocation of time, but it can ebb and flow if we're fundraising.
You're remote or you have an office?
Remote, but we have a we'll call like a third space in New York. Actually, she just opened it up a couple months ago. It's called Contrary NYC. And basically, like, it's an extension of the whole thesis, right? Which is we're trying to build infrastructure to support people at every step of their journeys, right? We're trying to help them find their first jobs, write them their first check, provide a home for them to meet like-minded technologists, you know, all the way through, you know, supporting them for their whole journey. So yeah, we have a space that we just opened up in New York recently. It's pretty awesome, but remote first as a firm. Yeah.
And then how do you communicate with the team? Slack, email, meetings?
Yeah.
What do you guys do?
Yeah. We use Microsoft Teams.
Teams?
No, I'm just kidding. Oh. No.
Some people do.
Yeah. No.
I've banned Teams, by the way.
Good.
One of the companies I don't know why the founder always wanted to use Teams.
Yeah.
And like, if you don't have the app on your phone or whatever, you like can't like call into it. Like, it's just like,
it's brutal.
It doesn't make any sense. And so I finally got frustrated and I was like, if I see another Teams link, yeah. I'll freak out.
Yeah. Yeah. It's brutal. Yeah. So no Teams. No. So we use a pretty traditional stack. So it's Slack, Zoom, email, whatever. And then the cadence that's been pretty good for us actually is, remote first as a team. I'd say out of the 20, maybe a little less than half of us are in SF. And then we have a couple in LA, New York, whatever. And then we kind of marry that cadence with a quarterly in-person team offsite. Mm. So every quarter, we basically go somewhere in person, usually just within the US, right? And to kind of take 3, 4, 5 days to, do feedback, level set on where we've been, where we're headed, and just have some team bonding time in person. I think it's been, there are certain people who are obviously more energized than others by in person. And so it's been a good balance for us. It allows everybody the flexibility to kind of do what they want, live where they want, live their own life, but also kind of show up for their colleagues.
You think people work as much remote as they would in the office, or do you think they work more remote than they would in the office?
I think it depends on the person. Right? Mm-hmm. I think you have to be internally motivated, mm-hmm. right? And you have to have ambition and want to build. I think, if you're talking about, Google style scale, I mean, there's no doubt that it's become a massively less productive company. But I think when you're a team of us with 20, where there's really high accountability across the board, right? It's like every single day, like you have your responsibilities, right? And if you don't have your responsibilities, you're not doing them. It's obvious, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think in those kinds of environments, it's actually fine. You have, for the most part, senior, ambitious, motivated people who are going to show up and do great work regardless of where they live. But I think once you start scaling meaningfully, right, call it past the century mark, I don't know if I'd do it if I were CEO. So, yeah. But there's a war of talent, right? You end up with a game theory.
There's not a
situation.
War of talent. This might be one of the things people disagree with.
All right. Yeah.
There's not a war of talent for the best companies. If you are a generational company, people are knocking down your door trying to work there. Right? Think of Anduril as a great example.
Yeah.
How many companies are actually competing with Anduril for talent? I don't know the answer, but like, I bet, I went and I looked one day, they have like 200 open roles, right?
Yeah.
And when you look at a business like that, if you're into defense tech, like where do you go work?
For sure, for
right?
sure.
And then maybe you're just like into tech, like where else are you gonna get to build this stuff?
Yeah.
Like it's just so differentiated than everything else that again, it's bombastic to say it's not a war on talent, but it is a very, very big competitive advantage, just simply the mission that you're doing. And 100%. So naturally you are able to attract talent that other people can't.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, but I think there's, a handful of companies, we can probably count on one or two hands, those companies. And I mean, frankly, those are probably the companies that people should be trying to go to work for.
Of course.
Right? But
there's
like,
a reason why people want to go work there.
Totally. Yeah. But for the rest, right? Like I think it's a much tougher sled, right? If you don't have the visibility yet, if you don't have the brand yet, and employer X says, "Oh yeah, you can stay remote," and you say, "Oh no, you have to be in person." I think many founders that I've talked to feel like it puts them in a hard spot, right? Where like, especially if you're a seed or Series A, right? Like you're still building your company. You're just trying to get the best engineers, kind of full stop, right? And if 95% of your competitors are saying that engineers can work, remote, it's just hard, right? And you don't have the time necessarily to be spinning your wheels on trying to find amazing engineers who also want to work full time. So it's a hard one, but I think it just depends on like where you're at in the company's evolution. So
yeah, that makes sense. Where can we send people to find you on the internet?
Yeah, we're at contrary.com or my Twitter.
So, what's your Twitter account?
It's just first initial last name, so E. Tarzinski, but it's a good brutal one to spell. So
contrary.com, how'd you get that?
Yeah. It was a slog, but we got it. Yeah.
Yeah, just paid up.
Yeah.
Or?
So we paid, but we have a fantastic broker that we use. And this person talk about hustle. They have unrelenting hustle. we sent them to half a dozen of our own portfolio companies at this point too.
Wow.
Yeah, he He will spare nothing really to help people get the domains they want. So yeah, I think one time he called up, he found the owner of the domain, right? And then he called up the spouse of the owner of the domain and told, because they originally didn't want to sell. And then he told them did you know that so-and-so, like your partner, has an offer to buy x.com or whatever it was for, you know, say $50,000. I don't know what it was. And he doesn't want to do it. And they were...
they went crazy.
Yeah, they went nuts. Literally the next day, sold. So this guy's pretty good. Yeah.
You just gotta love people who understand how the world
works.
That's
right. That's hustle. Yeah, that's absolute hustle.
All right. Thank you so much for coming and doing this. We will definitely do this again in the future.
Yeah, appreciate it.
Thanks so much for listening to today's episode. I really hope you enjoyed this one. Make sure you're subscribed on Apple, Spotify, or your favorite podcast player. And if you're looking to transition into a brand new job in the Bitcoin or crypto industry, we've got you covered. Head over to thecryptoacademy.io. My team and I have been working with the top HR teams in the industry to develop an intensive 3-week training program with over 50 live events. We teach you exactly what you need to know to break into the industry, including live interview prep and resume review. Our students have been hired at over 75 of the world's best Bitcoin and crypto companies. Go to thecryptoacademy.io to learn more. Again, that's thecryptoacademy.io. If you enjoyed today's episode, make sure you share it with your friends, and I'll see you all for the next episode.